Now we look back to a case from 12 years ago when Frank Jude Jr., a biracial man, was beaten by off-duty Milwaukee police officers. The incident led to federal convictions of police officers and a historic series of firings.
According to a new study published in the American Sociological Review, high-profile cases of police violence are impacting how often people call the police in matters of personal and public safety. The study said that after Frank Jude Jr.'s case, the number of 911 calls from African-American neighborhoods in Milwaukee dropped drastically.
John Diedrich joins us now. He's a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who's been covering this story. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, John, when we say you've been covering this story, you've been covering this new research, you were also covering the initial case, the beating of Frank Jude. Can you run through the sequence of events for us, take us back to the initial incident?
Sure. This was 12 years ago, October, almost exactly 12 years ago, October of 2004. Four individuals went to a party at an off-duty police officer's house. They left a short time after arriving. Their vehicle was surrounded. This is two men, two women. Their vehicle was surrounded by these off-duty police officers who accused Frank Jude of stealing a badge. Frank Jude and Lavelle Harris were pulled from this vehicle. The women were sort of set aside, and the other man ran, and Frank Jude then endured a long beating in the street, kicked in the head and body, his fingers pulled back, pens jammed in his ears, what a prosecutor later described as torture on the street. And then for a number of months after that incident, nobody was held accountable, nobody was arrested, none of the police officers would talk, even those who weren't involved. And then in February of 2005, our investigation revealed the extent of Frank Jude's injuries. We published a photo of his battered face and noted that nobody had been held accountable, though this had happened 3 months earlier.
And on-duty police officers had showed up, and one of them ended up participating in the beating, as I understand it?
That's right. That was one of the most sort of fantastic developments, if you will, not in a good way, a fantastic, because sort of unbelievable that that in fact an on-duty police officer came up who was not at the party, had not been drinking, and he was called, dispatched to really, you know, address what was going on, and then he joined in the beating and he stomped on Frank Jude's head until he could hear bones cracking, as he testified later.
So a horrific case. This did end up going into courts. Again, before we move to the new study, what ended up happening to the police officers involved?
So what happened was three were charged in state court. Ultimately, they were acquitted in state court. However, that wasn't the end of the case. Ultimately, eight were indicted in federal court. Seven of those were convicted. One was acquitted. And the three main culprits received between 15 and 17 years in federal prison, which they continue to serve now.
Let's take that now to today. This week, this new study comes out from sociologists. Obviously, this kind of event isn't something that's going to be good for police-community relations. Talk about this effort to measure what it did when this news came out.
So what happened was this study went and looked at more than a million 911 calls, not just cell, but all 911 calls through a period of time. And what these researchers from Harvard, Yale, and Oxford found was that there was a distinctive drop off in 911 calls after news of Frank Jude's beating became public through our investigation in the photo, especially as we got out there. What they found is they controlled for various factors, crime, what you'd expect to happen in certain neighborhoods, weather, because these calls sort of cycle. And they tested. They did a number of tests to say, were all calls affected by this? And it was really crime calls coming from predominantly black neighborhoods. They saw a big drop, and that drop was disproportionately falling in black neighborhoods. And that continued for more than a year after the first sort of public notice of the seriousness of the injuries.
And what do the researchers see this as? A marker, I guess, of a lack of trust, a lack of desire to have police participate in their lives, even when there's something bad going on?
Yeah, this is the finding, and I should note that this was done by a researcher from Harvard, Matt Desmond, who is very familiar with Milwaukee. He lived in Milwaukee back around this time. He did a lot of work. Your listeners might recall on evictions, and he's published a book on evictions and the unseen effects of that. He also wrote about domestic violence and the nuisance abatement ordinances and their effect on that. So he knows Milwaukee, and what his and his fellow researchers, what their hypothesis is that they tested is, did people lose confidence? Were they not willing to call 911 during this period of time? And when Matt Desmond, who is not only a sociologist but a statistician, looked at these numbers, he was really shocked at the size of the effect. And that's what, you know, statisticians and researchers look for, is how big of an effect are we looking at? And it was a huge effect, and it lasted for a good period of time. And he reflected on the fact that the firings, you noted the terminations, is the largest purge in Milwaukee Police Department history after this. 9 police officers fired and others demoted and so forth. That did not restore confidence. The charges did not restore confidence. And their theory is that the confidence really only came back as a result of the community having nowhere else to go, essentially the justice system having a corner on the market, if you will, a monopoly. But, interestingly, the calls fell again later, and they found more examples of this happening in the not-too-distant future after Frank Jude.
We're talking to John Diedrich, reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, about the aftermath of a police beating 12 years ago. A new study shows that it led to a decline in 911 calls in Milwaukee's African-American neighborhoods.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to John Diedrich, reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's talking to us about a new report that says the number of 911 calls from African-American neighborhoods in Milwaukee dropped after a well-publicized police beating 12 years ago. John, let's talk about the consequences now. This beating happens. The news comes out. Apparently, 911 calls from African-American neighborhoods drop. And then it looks like homicides go up after that. Did this report look into a connection?
They did. So what they tested was, you know, what was the result of this drop in 911 calls? And so if you looked at regular crimes, those that count on reporting, you would expect those to drop because the reporting's down. So things like assault or theft or things like that may be down if there's a lack of confidence in these communities. However, homicides are not susceptible to the drops and rises in reporting because of the consequence and the a body. So they did see this go up during the six-month period after the drop in 911 calls, and it was a significant increase, and I recall it well. It was the highest in a seven-year period. They did look at calls from 2004 to 2010, so this is a large period. Now, they did not include it in the findings section, and really that makes sense based on my reporting, talking to other folks and talking to the authors here, trying to attribute homicides to just one factor like this is hazardous. But the authors found enough of a connection here that they suggest that there is a connection between what was happening here and the fact that the drop in the calls and the spike in homicides that happened in 2005 in Milwaukee.
You know, we've heard lately about this concept of what some people have called the Ferguson effect after the Michael Brown shooting, the idea that police are worried about getting into a bad situation, maybe being videoed while they're doing it, doing less law enforcement, crime going up. People have also talked about the Jude effect since this happened. Can you talk about that?
Well, those are really, essentially, this report talks about essentially a new effect that hasn't been discussed, the Jude effect. What the authors are putting forth is that, talking to the lead author, Matt Desmond, he said, I just don't have any data to show that the Ferguson effect is real. They're trying to seek that data. Are there indications that police are, as the mayor of Chicago said, you know, going fetal, and that as a result, offenders are, you know, becoming more brazen? That sort of you know, passed into popular culture and usage already, but they don't see the data to support that. What they do see here is data that supports this idea that this concept of legal cynicism, that communities have seen problems and that they withdraw from participation in the legal system and cooperating. And really, it's not in one's self-interest, and if you're in a neighborhood where there's a lot of crime, not to report it because you don't get, you're not going to get help from law enforcement. But that is a reaction, and we've seen it in talking to the district attorney here in Milwaukee. He wasn't surprised by these findings. He's seen this, and when he ran for district attorney in 2006, John Chisholm, he saw this. He heard about this when he was a line prosecutor in 2005, picking juries, that individuals were bringing up, prospective jurors were bringing this up at the time. So he sees it as a real effect. He sees it as a complicated situation, though, and a number of officials have said, you know, a really complicated situation. But the Ferguson effect is something that is passed in there. But perhaps people will start talking about the Jude effect right now. And I should say there has been this spike in homicide in some cities recently, and that is a question that people have with all the cases, highly publicized cases. Is this what is causing that? Are these police incidents ultimately, you know, undercutting participation in the system, which could then be setting the grounds for homicide situations to unfold without calls being made prior when they might be stopped? The researchers say more work is needed, and this is an area ripe for more work.
Right. This is not an answered question yet, but this idea being that as legal cynicism increases, if people in a neighborhood don't trust the police, A, they might not report a situation to police that might stop something before a homicide happens. But also, if I read this right, there might be the idea that, well, we're not going to go to the police for justice. We're going to have to find it ourselves, solve our own problems, which also can sometimes lead to homicide, possibly.
Sure, that there could be so-called street justice. It's a complicated set of situations. Though I did talk to the lead researcher about this, and I said, is this a possibility that people were sort of resorting to street justice, individuals who are settling beefs between themselves? His point, though, was the drop was so large after Frank Jude that it was really ordinary, everyday people that were withdrawing from the system. It wasn't just individuals who may be somehow involved in the drug trade and they're solving their problems amongst themselves. This is everyday people. When you're seeing a 20% drop in calls, this is a widespread effect that suggests a much broader level of cynicism.
So this is a bystander, a neighbor, somebody in the neighborhood saying, yeah, this crime, I don't like it, it's a problem. I'm worried that something worse might happen if police are involved?
Yeah, well, that's right. I mean, and that in essence, if you see what happened with Frank Jude, and some other examples, let's say this came up again. There was another individual, Danielle Simpson, who was beaten, who's hit in the face with a radio in 2006. And same thing when that became publicized. Again, 911 calls dropped disproportionately in black neighborhoods. And there's even a case in Queens, New York, where they found an effect here in Milwaukee. So, you know, the possibility that cases in other cities might affect it. But that's exactly right, that things that, you know, could start small may not get reported. An assault or so forth may not get reported because of the concern, well, you know, what might happen in our community if we call police that we count on for help. But we've seen individuals be victimized by them. Maybe we'll just not call.
John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's John Diedrich, reporter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking to us about a new report on the impact of a case of police brutality on crime reporting in Milwaukee. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. If you're a fan of the Wisconsin Badgers, fall might be your favorite time of the year. We're smack dab in the middle of football season. The Badgers take on the Michigan Wolverines tomorrow. And we're only about a month out from the start of basketball and hockey season.
Regardless of support, the Badgers have a long and storied history filled with unique traditions and a lot of team lore.
Our next guest has compiled a lot of that lore into a new book, which offers Badger trivia for new and old fans alike, as well as a sneak peek behind the scenes of some of our state's most celebrated teams.
Jesse Temple covers Wisconsin. Wisconsin and Big Ten football for ESPN.com. He's the author of the book 100 Things Wisconsin Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. He joins us now. Jesse, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, Jesse, you cover, you know, the whole Big Ten. I assume you pay attention to sports around the country. What do you think it is, though, that makes the Badgers unique in the world of college sports?
Well, I think a big part of it is how passionate the fan base is, and I know you can say that about a lot of college programs, but another thing, especially for fans the last 25 years, is how good the football and men's basketball programs have been, perennially top 25 programs, so they're always nationally relevant, and I think that that makes games a little more special.
There's that, and there's the winning part of it, but they haven't always been a winning team in all sports, and even when they're not winning teams, it seems like people are having a lot of fun at these games. Is that part of the spirit?
Absolutely. A big part of this book is traditions as well. You know, whether they win or lose, people do show up and support these programs. And I think it is interesting that some of the biggest moments that have taken place when the team wasn't winning, maybe in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, what it meant to the fan base just to maybe be relevant for one game. So, there's a long storied history, and the programs have certainly gone through ups and downs, but the fans have stuck with them.
We opened up there with a little bit of jump around. There's a lot of those little unique, quirky traditions. Do you know how that one got started?
Yeah, it actually started in the mid-90s when there was someone looking to play some music to kind of amp up the fans, and they looked for a soundtrack, and Jump Around came on, and the fans started jumping up and down. And actually, there was a little minor controversy where there was a game where they didn't play it because there was construction in the stadium, and I think that the athletic department was concerned that there might be some issues with all the fans jumping around, and there was such a huge protest at that one game that they brought it back the next week, and since then they play it at every game at home games after the third quarter, and it's something that everybody always looks forward to.
So we have to make sure to engineer our sporting facilities to be jump around compatible.
Absolutely right.
Other song traditions, varsity. You go to a UW game, I think all sports, not just football and basketball. That is one, I mean, that's almost a religious element when you look at the looks on people's faces while they're singing varsity.
Yeah, it certainly is. And you know, there are so many songs that are out there. You know, if you want to be a Badger on Wisconsin, you know, it's been interesting to me kind of the evolution of what these songs mean when you think about the fifth quarter and what the band has represented. And, you know, I talked to Mike Lecrone, who's been the band director since the 60s, and people didn't really want to march military style during that era and weren't really all that interested in what the band had to play. And in the last 40 years, it's really become a tradition where people want to stick around after the game, sing those songs, you know, varsity included, and certainly just another tradition that adds to the lore of Badgers athletics.
You write about traditions. You also write about a lot of the people and maybe some of the famous moments. Talk a little bit about Barry Alvarez. It's hard to talk about UW athletics and not mention his name. Talk about how he's changed things at UW.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And he was kind enough to write the foreword for this book. He is the very first chapter in this book because of everything he's been able to do to turn this program around. And most people listening obviously know the story, but he came here in 1990. It was a dormant program, really, and he had a lot of bravado, and some people thought it was a little crazy, but 4 years later, they wound up winning the Rose Bowl and just completely changed the athletics department as a whole. The athletics department was $2.1 million in debt when he got here, and now, obviously, able to make money and sustain with quality programs, and Barry Alvarez, boy, you have to wonder where these teams would be without him.
Let's talk a little bit about another coach out now, but Bo Ryan, and I will say I don't follow UW men's basketball that closely, but man, that Final Four run they had in his last year, all the great names, it was a lot of fun to watch.
It certainly was, and before I was at ESPN, I was very fortunate to spend 4 years at Fox Sports Wisconsin covering both the football and the men's basketball program, so I had an opportunity to cover both those Final Four teams up close, and just a jovial, fun bunch, and quite honestly, you know, I'm sure I'll look back 30, 40 years from now and still remember that as the most fun team I've ever covered. Bo Ryan was able to let loose a little bit. I know people think he's very strict, and he certainly was, but those kids got him to open up, and they played with such joy and passion, and made the state proud with those two consecutive Final Four runs, no question about it.
Talking to Jesse Temple, author of 100 Things Wisconsin Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. It's not all football and basketball in your book. Another remarkable story in some ways, the women's hockey program at UW. I've been to a game. They pack that house. Talk about where that came from.
Yeah, actually, it got started, you know, after the, I believe it was the 98 Olympics, and I think that people started to realize, you know, NCAA hockey could be something that people care about. So after the Nagano Games, Wisconsin decided to bring about hockey, and so it was voted into existence in 1999-2000, and it's really incredible what the hockey program has become under head coach Mark Johnson, a perennial national title contender. It seems like every year they have a player that competes for National Player of the Year. So you're right, it isn't just about men's hockey and football and men's basketball. I mean, there are very talented teams across the board at Wisconsin, and women's hockey is right up there at the top.
Now, we've talked about some household names. Looking back in Wisconsin sports history, what are a couple names that strike you as ones that, hey, we're not talking about today that maybe we should be?
Well, I don't know if this exactly fits into the category, but these are a what could have been story, if you will. These are names that people might know, but one of my favorite stories in this book is about Bo Schembechler and Bobby Knight. They're two of the most famous football and men's basketball coaches in history, and actually both of those guys could have been at Wisconsin at the same time in the late 60s. I didn't know this when I started researching the book, but Bo Schembechler was a coach at Miami, Ohio. He wanted to coach here, and the athletics department basically botched the entire process. They brought him in essentially as a dog and pony show, never intending on hiring him, and somebody fell asleep in the meeting with him, and he called the athletic director and said, "I'm out. I'm not interested anymore." And a year later, Bobby Knight actually could have had the job here, but when he was at Army, before he went back to Army, they leaked it to the local papers, and Bobby Knight wasn't prepared for that. He hadn't told anybody at Army, and he wound up calling Bo Schembechler, of all people, because they both had ties to Ohio State. And Schembechler told him not to take the job. So all these years later, Bobby Knight went on to Indiana. Bo Schembechler goes to Michigan, and they tormented Badgers teams for years to come. So maybe not necessarily Badgers, but a story that I think a lot of people kind of wonder what if, and maybe something a lot of fans don't know.
Yeah, Bobby Knight, you know, we would have had a lot more chair throwing on the arena. Maybe we were okay without that
one. You're absolutely right, but he sure won a lot of games, won three national championships.
Well, you also talk about at least one administrator who's gone on to bigger and better things, too, Donna Shalala. Talk about her role in the rise of modern Wisconsin athletics.
Yeah, I mean, she's incredibly important and maybe somebody that gets lost to history because she wasn't here for the entire era, but played a big part. When she came here, this program wasn't very good, and she wanted to turn things around, and ultimately she was responsible for hiring Pat Richter as athletics director, and Pat Richter ultimately hired Barry Alvarez as well as a number of successful basketball coaches. And you know, the relationship that she developed with Barry Alvarez was very important, and the support from the top. You know, a lot of people maybe don't realize it. It's not just the athletics department, it's the school as a whole. So when you have that support, I think it makes things a lot easier. And certainly without her, another one of those people that you wonder where this program would be if she hadn't come through here.
One UW athlete you write about who had an amazing career shadowed by what came later, Susie Favor-Hamilton. Can you talk about her a little?
Yeah, I mean, obviously kind of like the golden child when she got done here, was a successful track athlete in high school in the state of Wisconsin, and then came here and won five outdoor NCAA track titles and just so many records, and actually had you know, the Big Ten Female Athlete of the Year honor named after her, and ultimately went through a series of issues after her time at Wisconsin in which you know, she was deemed to be you know, kind of manic depressive, and had to take medication for it, and you know, it's a very wild story. She ultimately wrote a memoir about it, and she wound up going to Las Vegas and working as a $600 per hour escort. And you know, when those things were revealed, her name kind of got taken off the Big Ten Female of the Year award athlete, and you know, maybe people wanted to distance themselves from her. But you know, just a fascinating life, and it certainly doesn't take away from the accomplishments she had when she was at Wisconsin and what she did to represent her country in the Olympics.
You can hear an interview with Susie Favor-Hamilton in the Central Time archives, by the way. Jesse, let's end on a high note. What are you looking forward to over the next year of Badger athletics?
Well, Well, right now, Wisconsin's football program certainly looks like it has the potential to be a college football playoff contender.
Yeah, surprising win over a really ranked, top-ranked team to start the season.
Yeah, they beat two top-10 teams for the first time in a season since 1962, so we'll see if they can keep it rolling. And the basketball program is a preseason top-10 team, and certainly a lot of people believe they can reach the Final Four again. So if all things go according to plan, we could be celebrating a football and a men's basketball incredibly successful seasons.
And now, Jesse, I know you don't just cover Wisconsin anymore, working with ESPN, but do you still make it to some Badger games?
Yeah, I'm still in Madison. I cover all the home football games, and Wisconsin is my primary beat when it comes to football. So I'm still around the program all the time.
Jesse, thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jesse Temple. He's the author of the new book, 100 Things Wisconsin Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die.